warrior's tongue. John Alexander is a busy man these days. Not only is he the one of the moving forces behind SciTech, a company that sells military-developed remote viewing skills to private enterprise. He's the program manager for non-lethal defense at the Los Alamos National Laboratory, an author of The Warrior's Edge, and a practitioner of the Gem of Mind Control Arts, neuro-linguistic programming. Today, after 32 years of military service, this retired colonel has the responsibility of drawing together and nurturing many non-lethal weapons devices which disable key electronic equipment, blind weapon sensors, or shut off the power to a capital city. He has drawn upon a variety of disciplines involving polymer chemistry, microbiotics, kinetics, acoustics, electrical engineering, material science, and information science, just to demonstrate their feasibility in the burgeoning science called non-lethal defense, at least so said Aviation Week and Space Technology. As the concept has evolved, Alexander is reported as saying, "We have come to focus our efforts on anti-material systems. If you can stop the machines of war, you can inhibit the prosecution of conflict." A Special Army Forces man, Alexander worked on advanced weapons concepts, including directed energy devices, for most of his career. Now he's employed as a civilian to provide Allied commanders with options to ambiguous situations, including the peacetime problems of counter-drug or anti-terrorist operations, through which many believe the last vestiges of freedom will fall. Alexander's teams, Aviation Week said, are developing scenarios for using the broad range of technologies while he is pushing for an even greater investment in large-scale modeling and simulations of non-lethal weapons, capabilities, and long-term effects. Each use of non-lethal weapons will depend on the situation, and each situation will need a coherent policy approved by senior leadership. The assumptions applied during concept development must be broadened beyond conventional applications of force. Alexander said, "I believe they offer alternatives that go far beyond just being adjuncts to traditional military operations." At their most effective, Aviation Week reported, non-lethal weapons would weaken combatants before a situation turns lethal. Key to the success of peacekeeping is the avoidance of casualties and hostage taking, which can lead to heightened tensions or outright hostilities. One has to think of them as they will inevitably be used against the dissident civilian populations of the Allied countries. Of course, a number of non-lethal or invisible weapons would fall under the category mind control. It makes no difference to Alexander. A psycho-civilized society might be very good for the national security. It doesn't matter how you play the game. The important thing is to win. In most wartime scenarios, we are going to win, Alexander said. So how you win becomes important. Take Waco, for example. Alexander may represent the lighter side of the Army's long-term PSYOPs campaign, if you call psychotronic weapons the lighter side. His current cause celeb is to sell the non-lethal weapon systems to law enforcement agencies. Congressman Charlie Rose was quoted saying, "I've seen some incredible examples of remote viewing, Alexander's specialty. So much so that I think we ought to pay close attention to developments in this field, especially to what the Soviets are doing. If they develop a capacity to have people mentally view the secret centers within this country, we could come to a point where we don't have any secrets." Is the metaphor, when information travels at the speed of light, there is no secrecy, manifesting? Ron McCrae, author of Mind Wars, wrote, "Early in 1981, a group of investors asked the congressman's help in securing Pentagon funding for an electronic paranoia inducer. Astronics, Inc. hoped to manufacture the psychic neuron disruptor, which, according to the investors, interferes with the connection between nerve cells in the brain and induces temporary paranoia. The psychological effect, they say, is similar to that of hallucinogenic drugs such as LSD, but transmitted electronically. The range of the existing device is supposedly limited, but could be extended for military applications. Rose submitted himself to a test of this machine, and he thinks it worked. We don't know how to build the hyperspatial nuclear howitzer, but we do know how to jam the synaptic connections of the nervous system. It deserves some research money. Despite weeks of negotiations and apparent interest in the Pentagon, no contract was signed. The company folded a year later. Rose also tested telepathic hypnosis with the help of Judith Skutch, a wealthy New York patron of psychic research who teaches a course in miracles at the Army's War College. With Rose standing at her side, McRae wrote, "Skutch and several other psychics associated with the Army War College broadcast psychic love emanations at Speaker O'Neill from the gallery at the House, commanding the unknowing majority leader to turn his head left and right on command, and then, according to one participant, commanding him to favor public works projects in the congressman's district. Skutch claims the same can be done to the Soviet leadership and Barbara Mux Harbard, a noted psychologist whom the Army consults on psychic developments, hopes to bombard the Kremlin with love, not missiles." Rose refuses to comment on the incident. Steve Bratcher of SKBI Research suggests that Speaker of the House, Tip O'Neill, may have died as a result of non-lethal weaponry. "I was given a tip by an intelligence agent. He asked me, 'Why don't you see if the tip was killed?'" Bratcher said, "O'Neill was sucker punched with electronics more than once. He was told about it. They turned it right around, used it two or three times on him. He knew about it. He knew that it worked. They sucker punched him again. Who's to say that he wasn't killed by it?" Whether or not O'Neill was killed by non-lethal weapons remained to be seen. It is well known that pacemakers which regulate heart patients can be stopped by microwaves. For a spook, John Alexander has a lot on the record, even for a spook in the most Cold War area. In Military Review Journal Limited, Colonel Alexander describes psychotronic weapons and telepathic hypnosis. He gazed wistfully into the future toward a day when the U.S. military would have the ability to heal or cause disease transmitted over distance, thus inducing illness or death for no apparent cause. He wrote about mind weapons which could give psychic ability to the personnel so they could read documents at a distance or visualize the geographic layout of an enemy's distant military installation, or to discern troop, ship, or submarine whereabouts. He foresaw the day when the ordinary human could use their mind to command an enemy to do something he would not. Alexander spoke of what might be the ultimate weapon of the future. "Some say the government spent a lot of research on radionic weaponry." He spoke of the disease projection, a technology by which the U.S. military could induce illness or death, especially heart attacks and asphyxiation. He said, "Uncontrollable fright and fear could also be generated by mind power." He postulated that there would come a day when we'd have mind alteration, which was, quote, "the long-distance ability to cause an opponent's mind, say that of a president or prime minister, to grow confused and unable to function," end quote. Some of it would appear to be disinformation, like when Alexander spoke of psychokinesis, the ability to move physical objects through mind power. One's first impression would be that it all was disinformation, all the stuff about psychotronic weaponry indeed. However, it is known that the cryptocracy has funded 50 years of research into telepathy, hypnosis, and remote viewing, and more than one laboratory experiment has indicated that the mind can move physical objects and even erase a magnetic tape, interfere with internal computer signals. Armin Viktorian, a British researcher with dubious credentials, got on Alexander's case and published his research in London in a socialist lobster magazine, calling Alexander "The Pentagon's Penguin," and then title of his article. From that time forth, Alexander and Victorian were not friendly. Victorian's article began. On April 22nd, 1993, both BBC One and BBC Two showed me on their main evening news bulletins rather lengthy piece concerning America's latest development in weaponry, the non-lethal weapons concept. David Shurkman, a BBC defense correspondent, interviewed retired U.S. Army Colonel John Alexander and Janet Morris, two of the main proponents of the concept. The concept of non-lethal weapons is not new. Non-lethal weapons have been used by the intelligence, police, and defense establishment in the past. Several Western governments have been used as a variety of non-lethal weapons in more discreet and covert manners. It seems that the U.S. government is about to take the first step towards their open use. Victorian described that Alexander was the man behind the thrust to develop non-lethal weapons. He pointed out that in December of 1980, he'd published the article, "The New Mental Battlefield," in the U.S. Army's journal, Military Review, which he said caught the attention of senior army generals who encouraged him, Alexander, to pursue what they termed soft option kill technologies. After retiring from the army in 1988, Alexander joined the Los Alamos National Laboratories and he began working with Janet Morris, the research director of the U.S. Global Strategy Council. Chaired by Dr. Ray Klein, formerly deputy director of CIA, Victorian revealed what he had found by examining the backgrounds of Morris and Alexander. Throughout 1990, the U.S. GSC lobbied the main national laboratories, major defense contractors, and industry, retired senior military intelligence officers. The result was the creation of Non-Lethality Police Review Group, led by Major Chris Adams, United States Air Force retired, former Chief of Staff, Strategic Air Command. They already have the support of Senator Sam Nunn, chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee. According to Janet Morris, the military attaché at the Russian embassy has contacted U.S. GSCS about the possibility of converting military hardware to a non-lethal capability. In 1991, Janet Morris issued a number of papers giving more detailed information about USGSC's concept of non-lethal weapons. Shortly after, the U.S. Army Training and Doctrine Command at Fort Monroe, Virginia, published a detailed draft report on the subject entitled Operation Concept for Disabling Measures. The report included over 20 projects in which John Alexander was involved at the Los Alamos National Laboratories. In a memorandum dated April 10, 1991, titled, "Do We Need a Non-Lethal Defense Initiative?" Paul Wolfowitz, Under Secretary of Defense for Policy, wrote to Defense Secretary Dick Cheney, "A U.S. lead in non-lethal technologies would increase our options and reinforce our position in the post-Cold World War. Our research and development efforts must be increased." Victorian wanted to know how lethal or non-lethal is, and he reviewed the specious arguments put forth by the purveyors of invisible warfare. To support their non-lethal weapons concept, Janet Morrison argues that while war will always be terrible, a world power deserving its reputation for humane action should pioneer the principles of non-lethal defense. In defining a non-lethal strategy, she seeks to establish a doctrine for the use of non-lethal weapons by the U.S. in crisis, at home or abroad, in a life-serving fashion. She totally disregards the offensive lethal aspects become available to rogue nations. Despite her arguments that non-lethal weapons should serve the U.S. interest, at home and abroad, by protecting power without indiscriminately taking lives over destroying property, she admits that casualties cannot be avoided. Closer examination of the types of weapons to be used as non-lethal invalidates her assertions about the non-lethality. According to her white paper, the areas where non-lethal weapons could be used are regional and low-intensity conflict, adventurism, insurgency, ethnic violence, terrorism, narco-trafficking, and domestic crime. She believes by identifying and requiring a new category of non-lethal weapons tactics and strategic planning, the U.S. can reshape its military capability to meet the already identifiable threats that they might face in a multipolar world where American interests are globalized and American presence widespread. The inventory of invisible weapons Victoria found in Janet Morris's white paper recommends two types of life-conserving technologies. Quote, to destroy or impair electronics or in other ways stop mechanical systems from functioning. Amongst current technologies from which this category of non-lethal weapons would or could be chosen are chemical and biological weapons for their anti-material agents which do not significantly endanger life or the environment, or anti-personal agents which have no permanent effects. Laser blinding system to incapacitate this electronic sensors or optics, i.e. light detection and ranging. Already the Army Interim Free School is developing one man portable and operated laser weapon systems known as the Infantry Self-Defense System. The U.S. Army's Armament Research, Development, and Engineer Center is also engaged in the development of non-lethal weapons under the program called Low Collateral Damage Munitions, LCDM. LCDM is trying to develop technologies leading to weapons capable of dazzling and incapacitating missiles, armored vehicles, and personnel. When inventorying the supposed non-lethal electromagnetic technologies, Morrison made no mention of mind control or the well-documented destructive qualities of the electromagnetic spectrum. Victoria remains faithful to Morrison's inventory. Non-nuclear electromagnetic pulse weapons. As General Norman Schwarzkopf told the U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff, one such weapon stationed in space with a wide area pulse capacity has the ability to fry enemy electronics. But what would be the fate of the enemy personnel in such a scenario? In a joint project with the Los Alamos National Laboratories and with technical support from the Army's Harry Diamond Laboratories, RDEC are developing high-powered microwave projectiles. According to RDEC, the Diamond Lab has already completed the radio frequency effects analysis on a representative target set for HPM. Among the chemical agents, so-called supercaustics, millions of times more caustic than hydrofluoric acid, are prime candidates. An artillery round could deliver jellied superacids which could destroy the optics of heavily armored vehicles or tanks, vision, blocks, or gas, and could be used to silently destroy key weapon systems. From the covert to the ridiculous, Victorian's article covered the less lethal aspects of invisible warfare. It talked about the new, now widely publicized use of net-like entanglements for SEAL teams and stealthy metal boats with low or no radar signature for night actions or any born or come ashore stealthy scenario. It describes as more colorful concepts the use of chemical metal embrittlement, often called liquid metal embrittlement, and anti-material polymers, which are supposed to be used in aerosol dispersal systems, spreading chemical adhesives or lubricants, Teflon-based lubricants on enemy equipment from a distance. You can just see the Iraqi tank battalions now, spinning their treads on the crossroads of Kuwait. Was this the kind of stuff just to soften us up for the anti-personal non-lethal pitch? Janet Morris was not to be the first science fiction writer who had worked for the cryptocracy. Remember, there were L. Ron Hubbard, Robert Heinlein, and a host of others in the Philadelphia experiment days. Janet Morris, co-author of The Warrior's Edge, is best known as a science fiction writer, but has been a member of the New York Academies of Science since 1980. She is also a member of the Association for Electronic Defense and was the research director of the U.S. Global Strategy Council. She was initiated into the Japanese art of biogenetics, Janri, the Indonesian Brotherhood of Subud, and graduated from the Silver Course in Advanced Mind Control. She had been conducting remote viewing experiments for 15 years and had worked on a research project investigating the effects of the mind on probability in computer systems. Her husband, Robert Morris, was a former judge and key member of the American Security Council. According to Victorian, Morris's inventory of non-lethal personal weapons included handheld lasers, which were meant to dazzle, but also could cause the eyeball to explode and to blind the target. She pushed for isotropic radiators, explosively driven munitions capable of generating very bright omnidirectional light, with similar effects to laser guns and high-powered microwaves, which she revealed the U.S. Special Operations Command already had as a portable microwave weapon. Myron L. Weisbrot, a Duke University ophthalmologist and expert in laser weapons, stated, U.S. Special Forces can quietly cut enemy communications, but they also can cook internal organs. Victoria said that another non-lethal weapon Morris and Alexander waxed poetic over was infrasound. Acoustic beams, in conjunction with the Scientific Applications and Research Associates, SARA, of Huntington, California. RDEC and Los Alamos laboratories were busy developing high-power, very low-frequency acoustic beam weapons. At the same time, they were exploring methods of projecting non-diffracting, i.e. non-penetrating, high-frequency acoustic bullets. RDEC scientists were also looking into methods of using pulsed chemical lasers. This class of lasers project hot, high-pressure plasma in the air in front of a target surface, creating a blast wave that will result in variable but controlled effects on material and personnel. Of course, it's public knowledge, Victorian said, that governments have used infrasound as a mode of crowd control in France, as they have used very, very low frequency VLF sound, 20 to 35 kilohertz, or low frequency modulations to cause nausea, vomiting, and abdominal pain. Some very low frequency sound generators in certain frequency ranges can cause the disruption of human organs, and at high power levels can crumble masonry. The CIA had a similar program in 1978 called Operation Pick, which included bouncing radio or microwave signals off the ionosphere to affect mental functions of the people in selected areas, including Eastern European nuclear installations. Are you hearing this, Nick Beckage? Victorian thought that the non-lethal weapon concept opens up a new Pandora's box of unknown consequences. He discovered that the main personality behind NLW was retired Colonel John B. Alexander, born in New York in 1937. Alexander spent part of his career as a commander of Green Beret Special Forces in Vietnam, led Cambodian mercenaries behind enemy lines, and took part in a number of clandestine programs, including Phoenix. He currently holds the post of Director of Non-Lethal Weapons in the Los Alamos National Laboratories. Alexander obtained a B.S. from the University of Nebraska and an M.A. from Pepperdine University. In 1980, he was awarded a Ph.D. from Walden University for his thesis to determine whether or not significant changes in personality and spirituality occur in persons who attend a Kubler-Ross life-death transition workshop during the period June through February 1979. His dissertation committee was chaired by Elizabeth Kubler-Ross. Victoria said that Alexander had long interest in what is used to be regarded as fringe areas. As an example of fringe areas, Victorian said that Alexander had, while a captain in the infantry at Schofield Barracks, Honolulu, gone diving in the Bimini Islands looking for the most lost continent of Atlantis. He was an official representative for the Silver Mind Control Organization and a lecturer at pre-cataclysmic civilizations. Alexander is also a past president and a board member of the International Association for Near-Death Studies, and Dr. C.B. Scott Jones performed ESP experiments with dolphins. More than just exploring the fringes of science, retired Major General Albert N. Stubblebine, former director of U.S. Army Intelligence and Security Command, and Alexander were both on the board of a remote viewing company called SciTech. The company also employed Major Edward Dames, ex-Defense Intelligence Agency, Major David Morehouse, ex-82nd Airborne Division, and Ron Blackburn, former Wycombe scientist and specialist at Kirkland Air Force Base. Victorian said that Alexander's company, SciTech, had received several government contracts. For example, during the Gulf crisis, the Department of Defense asked to reuse remote viewing to locate Saddam's Scud missiles. In 1992, the FBI sought PSI, SciTech, assistance to locate kidnapped Exxon executive. SciTech's promotional material said that it specializes in proprietary studies for the science and industry on a contract basis. That's the way that CIA often likes it. The material says that, quote, SciTech consists of a select technically qualified group of professional analysts who provide a unique data collection capability not available anywhere else in the world. We are a team of highly trained remote viewing specialists. Remote viewing is a science, it says, which has been validated by government and private scientific groups over the last two decades. Briefly stated, a remote viewer is able to locate and accurately describe things and events distant in time and space. It says the company has developed remote viewing into a powerful investigative tool, and it can provide you with a reliable information that simply may not be available via any other means. Among the potential applications, the brochure lists, quote, increase understanding of natural and scientific phenomena, concept development, describe alternative, often unique approaches, seed ideas, help focus R&D into high payoff pathways. Establish cause-effect connectivity linkages, discover hidden variables. Quickly sort, analyze, and project the most promising critical enabling technologies. Review the key aspects of prior events, relook accidents, establish the source of device or experiment failure. Penetrate, survey, and describe locations that are inaccessible via any other means. Conceptual and detailed subject sketches, target geometries. Among the attempts at remote viewing for hire, the company advertises, quote, the crisis profile of Saddam Hussein. A large company with strategic oil interests in the Mideast wanted to remote viewers to look at the Gulf's war effects upon the near and far term price of oil and analyze Saddam Hussein himself. SciTech tried to look into his intent, motivation, and emotional and behavior states, penetrated his war room, gathered information concerning his battle plans, operations, force strengths, and possible deception schemes, and to provide a six-month general outlook for the region. Investigative report, hydrogen-based automobile power plant, RDT&E. A major auto company hired SciTech to perform a worldwide search for key research and applied engineering work related to hydrogen-powered automobiles. The brochure says, we located and described engineering projects in North America, Japan, France, China, Germany, and the USSR. Our final report placed emphasis upon the most potentially successful of the projects and included sketches of prototype designs and descriptions of essential associated engineering features, such as turbines, flywheels, hydraulic and electronic computants. Interestingly, we determined that most potential successful design would not be to our customers. Projected key technologies for lunar in-situ resource processing. This client was a large engineering company who wanted help in selecting or creating the most economic technologies with which to extract lunar elements, primarily oxygen, for intended use as possible lunar-based energy source and as a source of propulsion for Moon-Mars expeditions. SciTech furnished the company descriptions, sketches of actual future lunar mining and resource processing operations, and recommendations with regard to power generation devices. Other SciTech contracts are only listed by the description title. Quote, Enigma Penetration, Soviet Phobos 2 Spacecraft Image Anomaly. Projected Technologies, Advanced Deep Space Propulsion Systems. Clandestine Iraqi Biological Weapons Facilities. A relic of KLL Flight 007 shootdown. Atmospheric ozone depletion, projected consequences, and remedial technologies. Saint Exupéry crash site. A technical remote viewing survey of Martian surfaces anomalies. Joint U.S.-Russian remote viewing survey of Titan. Key Latin American narcotics transshipments facilities. One source close to the company said, a number of these attempts didn't bear much reliable fruit. For $3,000, you can take a SciTech course and learn how to remote view yourself. In a mere 7 days of intensive training in the technical remote viewing course, developed by none other than SRO Golden Boy psychic Ingo Swan, you can learn how to acquire a target, person, thing, or event, regardless of a location in time and space, set up and initiate a topical research, discriminate between target-associated data, imagination, personal analysis, which would probably be the most difficult part of succeeding at this, and learn a system by which you can structure elaborate target-associated information in several analysis-facilitating formats. One would suspect that the processes of NLP are put to good use here. Should you wish to attend one of SciTech's courses, the brochure says, allow an extra day to visit Los Alamos National Laboratory and or Santa Fe Institute. With Mr. Richard Groller and Janet Morris as co-authors, Alexander published The Warrior's Edge in 1990. The book describes in detail various unconventional methods which would enable the practitioner to acquire human excellence and optimum performance, and thereby become an inconceivable warrior. The purpose of the book, the author writes, is to unlock the door to the extraterrestrial human potentials inherent in each of us. To do this, we, like governments around the world, we must take a fresh look at non-lethal traditional methods of affecting reality. We must raise human consciousness of the potential power of the individual body-mind system. The power to manipulate reality, we must be willing to retake control of our past, present, and ultimately our future. Alexander is a good friend of Vice President Al Gore. Their relationship dates back to 1983 when Gore was in Alexander's neurolinguistic program in training by Wyatt Woodsmall, a student of Anthony Robbins and Richard Bandler. So one would assume most of SciTech's customers are government agencies or government contractors. In his book, The Warrior's Edge, Alexander said that NLP was presented to selected general officers and senior executive service members, a set of techniques to modify behavior patterns. Among the first generals to take the course was then Lieutenant General Max Thurman, who later went on to receive his fourth star and become Vice Chief of Staff at the Army, Commander, Southern Command. Among other senior participants were Tom Downey and Major General Stubblebine, former Director of Army Intelligence Security Command. In 1983, the Jedi Master from the Star Wars movie provided an image and a name for the Jedi Project. The Jedi Project's aim was to seek and instruct teachable methods of behavior physical excellence using unconventional means. According to Alexander, the Jedi Project was to be followed up by neurolinguistic programming skills. By using the influence of friends such as Major General Stubblebine, who was then head of U.S. Army Intelligence and Security Command, he managed to fund Jedi. In reality, the concept was old hat, rechristened by Alexander. Victorian wrote, the original idea, which was to show how human willpower and human concentration affect performance more than any other single factor, using NLP skills, was the brainchild of three independent people. Fritz Erickson, a Gestalt therapist, Virginia Satir, a family therapist, and Eric Erickson, a hypnotist. The above is incorrect and is misquoted from Alexander's book, The Warrior's Edge. But it was incorrect in that, too. NLP practitioners Bandler and Grinder modeled successful therapists who were Fritz Perls, father of Gestalt therapy, Virginia Satir, a remarkably talented family therapist, and Milton Erickson, a victim of polio, genius hypnotist, and the true father of the basic NLP, who came up with the first observation of breakthrough information. Communication is 90% behavioral, 5% tonal, and 5% content. All of Erickson's work is now in print. He was a master of therapeutic metaphor. I interviewed him in 1976 and 1977 while doing my basic research for Operation Mind Control. Anthony Robbins told me about teaching the Army how to improve their skills as marksmen and at the training I received from him. Wyatt Woodsmall, mentioned in Alexander's book, taught us some courses, one of which was sort patterns. Alexander's book contains errors such as the above, naming Milton Erickson Eric Erickson. He also seems to miss one of the most valuable lessons which makes NLP succeed. The person doing the NLPing must remain unattached to the person's content, must not second-guess their outcome, and must assert their intention toward a win-win situation. This allows the unique power of the creative imagination to surprise the NLP practitioner. It would seem from his writing that Alexander didn't have a clue about this, and like most defensive people, felt quite at home in the defense business. In a telephone conversation with Victorian, Janet Morris confirmed John Alexander's involvement in mind control and psychotronic projects at the Los Alamos National Laboratories. She told Victorian, Alexander and his team have recently been working with Dr. Igor Smirnov, a psychologist from the Moscow Institute of Psychocorrections. Victorian said after Morris visited Russia in 1991, top Soviet mind controllers were invited to the U.S. Morris was shown a technique which was pioneered by the Russian Department of Psychocorrection at Moscow Medical Academy. The Russians employ the technique to electronically analyze the human mind in order to influence it. They input subliminal command messages, Victorian reported, using keywords transmitted in white noise or music, using an infrasound, very low frequency type transmission. The acoustic psychocorrection message is transmitted via bone conduction. Earplugs would not restrict the message. To do that would require an entire body protection system. According to the Russians, the subliminal messages bypass the conscious level and are effective almost immediately. Another one of Alexander's collaborators, Victorian revealed, was C.B. Scott Jones, the former assistant to Senator Claiborne Pell, Democrat, Rhode Island. Scott Jones was a member of the U.S. Naval Intelligence for 15 years, as well as assistant naval attaché. In the 1960s, Jones has briefed the President's Scientific Advisory Committee and has testified before House and Senate committees on intelligence matters, Victorian said. After the Navy, he worked in the private sector research and development community involving the U.S. government-sponsored projects for the Defense Nuclear Agency. Defense Intelligence Agency and U.S. Army Intelligence and Security Command. He has been head of the Rockefeller Foundation for some time and also chairs the American Society for Psychical Research. Victorian said the people he has mentioned were all birds of a feather. He explained the meaning of that by explaining their code names. Alexander and C.B. Jones are members of the Avery, a group of intelligence and Department of Defense officers and scientists with a brief to discredit any serious research in the UFO field. Each member of the Avery bears a bird's name. Jones is Falcon, John is Penguin. The literature of ufology was filled with stories about one other agent of the so-called Avery, a UFO researcher known as William Moore, who was introduced to John Alexander at a party in 1987 by Scott Jones. Moore went public, confessing in front of an audience at a conference held by the Mutual UFO Network on July 1, 1989, in Las Vegas, that he was promised inside information by the senior members of the Avery and returned for his obedience and service to them. Moore revealed how he participated in the program and dissemination of the disinformation which had been fed to him by various members of the Avery. He also confessed how he had been instructed to target one individual in particular, an electronics expert named Dr. Paul Benowitz. What made Benowitz a target, according to Victoria, was he had accumulated some UFO film footage and documentation of electronic signals which were taking place in 1980 over the Manzano weapons storage areas at Kirkland Air Force Base, New Mexico. Victorian said that as a result of Moore's involvement, coupled with some surreptitious entries and psychological techniques, Benowitz ended up in a psychiatric hospital. Just before the publication of Victorian's first paper unmasking two members of the Avery, he says that he was visited by two of their members, Mourning Dove and Hawk, who also traveled to the UK with a message from the senior ranks advising Victorian not to go ahead with his expose. Victorian says he rejected that proposal. Immediately after the publication of Victorian's paper, John Alexander confessed that he was indeed a member of the Avery. He said his nickname was Penguin. The accuracy of Victorian's information was further confirmed to him by yet another member of the Avery, Ron Pendelfoy, and Pelican. Pendelfoy works in the rocket industry and missile section of the Office of Deputy Director of Science and Technology, CIA. In his book, Out There, the New York Times journalist Howard Bloom refers to a UFO working group within the Defense Intelligence Agency. Despite the DIA's repealed official denials, the existence of this working group has been confirmed to Victorian by more than one member of the group itself, including an independent source in the Office of Naval Intelligence. He said, "The majority of the group's members are senior members of the Avery. Dr. Christopher Green, Blue Jay, from the CIA, Howard Poloff, OWL, ex-NSA, Dr. Jack Verona, Raven, DOD, one of the initiators of the DIA's Sleeping Beauty Project, which aimed to achieve battlefield superiority using mind-altering electromagnetic weaponry. John Alexander, Penguin, and Ron Pandolfi, Pelican, the mysterious Colonel Harold E. Phillips, who appears and blooms out there, is none other than John B. Alexander. John Alexander's position as the program manager for the contingency missions of conventional defense technology, Los Alamos National Laboratories, enabled him to exploit the Department of Defense's Project Reliance, which encourages a search for all possible forms of existing incipient technologies before developing new technologies in-house, to tap into a wider range of exotic topics, sometimes using defense contractors. McDonnell Douglas Aerospace, Victorian said, had several reports, some of which were compiled before his departure to the Los Alamos National Laboratories when he was the Army Intelligence, which showed Alexander's keen interest in any and every exotic subject, UFO, ESP, psychotronics, anti-gravity devices, near-death experiences, psychological warfare, and non-lethal weaponry. John Alexander utilizes the bank of information he has accumulated to try to develop psychotronic, psychological, mind control weaponry, Victorian wrote. He began thinking about non-lethal weapons a decade ago in his paper, The New Mental Battlefield. He seems to want to become a master. If he ever succeeds in his ambition, the rest of us ordinary mortals had better watch out, Victorian said. But Armin Victorian didn't watch out enough. Just before this edition was printed, received a letter from Victorian which read, quote, "What I'm about to tell you is stuff that I always thought would happen to others and not to us until it did happen. Despite the long research experience of dealing with the dirty tricks orchestrated by various governments to harass and frighten members of the public, I have to confess that at this point in time myself, me and my family feel somewhat confused, and if I don't add frightened, I might not be telling the truth." Number one, on June 21st, 1994, a rainy day, I was on my way back from our weekly shopping, driving in a busy urban road where a car parked on the side of the road without using his indicator veered in front of me, attempting to make a U-turn. As a result, I collided with him and my car was written off. I am lucky that no serious injuries occurred to me and I escaped while was badly shaken. There were two people in the car, which was odd because the color Volvo immediately after the incident, the driver, male, came out and attempted to assault me. His companion, a female, shouted at him. He returned to his car, which was only dented on the side, and drove away. I managed to take his number plate, etc. Number 2. On June 23rd, 2 days later, after returning home with my children from their school, I noticed a red car parked in front of our house with two passengers in it, a male and a female. After we entered, the male passenger, who was really well-dressed, came out, walked to our front window, gazed into our room for a couple minutes, then he went back to his car. A few minutes later, he returned with his female companion and rang our doorbell. When I opened the door, he addressed me with a very friendly voice as though he had known me for years, calling me one of my previous pen names, which I have not used in many years. I told him I am not the person he just addressed. He produced a card, clenched in his hand, which I could not see anything of, and asked if they could come in, which I refused. He then looked at his female companion, who was standing beside him. Then they walked away, got in their car, and drove away. Number 3. On July 14th, whilst I was away on business, I received a call from my wife. She was clearly distressed. She told me that the police had raided our house and had arrested her, taking away some of my research work as well as our personal documentation. At this point, the receiver was grabbed from her hand, and a male voice introducing himself as a police officer asked me to introduce myself as a certain police station as soon as possible. He told me that he tried to avoid the embarrassment of arresting me by his colleagues at where I was. I drove back to the Nottingham and introduced myself to the police station they had named. They were still keeping my wife in custody. Eventually, they tried to interview me in front of my solicitor. I had asked to be present. I maintained my right of silence throughout. We were both released on bail pending further investigation. The alleged charge makes me laugh for the heavy-handedness they had applied to us. Obtaining the British telecom services with deception, which we both totally rejected. It is to our mind a plan to frame me, using my wife perhaps as a bargain chip. Number 4. On July 31st, 1994, whilst I was washing the dishes after lunch, I noticed some unusual marks on our kitchen window glass. Upon closer examination, I noticed that someone had attempted to cut the glass. To us, it was just a signal. I reported to the police. Our house had been burglared on 5 previous occasions. I have written several letters to the Home Office and other British authorities with no response to date. All my direct and indirect inquiries as to who carries out such surreptitious entries has either been ignored or responded to with silence. In each occasion, only research work and personnel and financial documents have gone missing. Furthermore, since 1989, I have records. My mail has been continuously tampered with. Some mail has been opened, some gone missing. My inquiries to the Royal Mail have borne no fruit. Number 5. On August 4th, 1994, I had gone to report it to the police and meet my solicitor, my attorney. I parked my car into a multi-story car park in a shopping mall adjacent to the offices. When I returned, the door on the passenger side was wide open. Nothing had gone missing. Again. Number 6. The CIA, in a recent response to my PA, requested he acknowledge that they do indeed keep a file on me. Number 7. I might have told you that I possess a memorandum in confidence issued by John Alexander, where he openly admits that he has approached the CIA, NSA, and the State Department in an attempt to sort me out. He goes further to add that the U.S. agencies in return have been in contact with the British intelligence about my research work. Number 8. On July 15th, 1994, I went to the office of our local Nottingham City Council for a routine inquiry about our council tax. The VDU computer screen was facing me on the clerk. When he punched my name into the computer, to my surprise, the computer showed all the details about my arrest. According to the Data Production Act of 1984, it is illegal to have any such records on anyone. These records must be kept on the police national computer only. The police have assured us that even though they did not make such an input to the PNC because there have been no charges, the question is who has leaked this information out? I have already filed a complaint against the City Council through the Data Protection Registrar, pending its outcome. I don't hold my hopes high. So, here we are. In a short period of time, we have been through this stuff the movies are made of. If you want to publicize my case, you are more than welcome, and I would welcome it. In brief, we need help. I never thought I am such a thorn in their eyes. I seldom publish anything, Victorian wrote. Tell me, if you will, what is your advice? One might not give as much credence to Victorian's troubles if Martin Cannon hadn't also had similar troubles. Both Cannon and Alexander researching UFO phenomena and mind control. They both asked a lot of people a lot of questions about John Alexander. They both believed they were targets of harassment, or worse, from the cryptocratic connections of Alexander. I listened to the tape-recorded conversations Cannon provided me. He identified the voice of that of his old friend, fellow UFO researcher, John Alexander's wife, Vicky. On the tape, she told Cannon, John and Ed are really steamed up over what you've written, and they're asking Gordon, Cannon explained. He thought Mrs. Alexander meant it was Gordon Novell, a CIA asset alleged to be involved in the Kennedy assassination, to do something about it. Photograph. Colonel John Alexander holds up a pretzel made perfect through the psychometric powers of himself and Hal Putoff, who stands proudly behind him. Both gentlemen appear satisfied with their accomplishment, the creation of the world's first quantumly organized perfect pretzel. They plan to train German workers in remote viewing and psychometry for employees in their astral projection pretzel works.